Hi. Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July 19th, 1996. In the fireside room this evening, our speaker is Rebecca Wee. This evening, she will be conducting a poetry reading. Let's listen in.
This is a poetry reading by Rebecca Wee. I'm saying that for the radio audience. I think we're rolling now. My name is G. Barnes, and I'll be introducing Rebecca. For me, that's a great pleasure. And we'll be having plenty of time for vespers. I think you may have time for a few questions if you care to, or remarks. Congratulations, all that kind of thing. You're in for something very fine here, so I'm glad that you have. Let me put my other glasses on. We'll just do a little bit of the usual poetry reading, sort of honorifics, and the long words part, and then I'll try to set a little bit of a setting for you, and then clear out of here so that you can have that in a straight way. But there are certain traditions that are well to follow when one is participating as an audience member and as kind of an introducer and a cultural event. So. Rebecca Wee teaches creative writing at Augustana College in Elkhart, Illinois. Since taking her studio degree in art writing from George Mason University, where she studied with many of contemporary literature's most powerful and influential poets and other writers. She has received thus far 7 important literary prizes and awards, the most recent coming from the Minnesota State Arts Board. Rebecca Wee has served as poetry editor for several magazines and as production editor at Major House. Besides Augustana, she has taught at George Mason, St. Olaf, and Gustavus Adolphus. Poems by her have appeared in distinguished literary journals across America, and the manuscript of her book, Intarsia, is with a fine publisher now. A few words kind of about poetry in general. Ballerinas, as you know, kind of top out at like 23 or 28 or something. Certainly by age 30, they're choreographers. Poets, though, for poets it takes a very long time, generally. Rebecca Wee is what's called a young poet. For the purposes of literary criticism, I'm even called. If not a young poet, I can take my cue from a little argument I was having with a much younger poet several years ago. At that time, the noted American poet Marvin Bell was 53, and I referred to him as a young poet. And he said, Marvin Bell is 53. And then when we got back to town from a little excursion we were taking, we found in criticism Marvin referred to as a youngish poet. Poets, all poets, know that poetry, for the most part, takes a long time to come to full fruition. These are some poems by a prodigy. And I want to say that in an almost Mozartian way, it seems to me. I've had a couple of weeks with the poems in the manuscript. And I guess I would certainly say that Rebecca was a prodigy at paying attention. It's a necessary kind of choice. Very early in her life, and having trustworthy intuitions and sensitivities. Some have that. Several years ago, I think it was about 1970, the National Council of Christians and Jews studied artists to see what contribution artists make to society, to churches, and how to regard them as religious people. Their long report begins by saying, the artist loves the world. It's a conclusion they came to. Miss Wee certainly loves the world. You will find out in these poems, but not blindly. This poetry is packed, you will notice, with the tangible, which is not to say there is mystery lacking here. It is a great deal of mystery, a great deal of spirituality. I find the poetry to be characterized by the sensory and also by a rich musicality. There is about these poems something very feminine, and even if I may say so, ladylike. As well, it owns aspects of, it seems to me, athleticism, a spunkiness. The work is, I think, strident and muscular, if I may say it that way. Rebecca Bee is a poet upon whom one suspects damn little is lost and even less squandered. There is particularity in these poems. There are names of things and places, things we talk about every day. And they are elevated in their language by the composition itself. All of these things, in simple, common ditch, Timothy, an imagined bridge painted teal, or was it imagined? Iron, bone. These are the words that some of these poems are made of. And poems are, after all, made of words, really not ideas. This work is informed by travel in the classic sense. I mean that sort of travel which was, until very recently, an urgent part of a person's self-education. Rebecca Lee has not been a tourist. But she's gone out hunting something. She's gone out hunting things. She has sometimes been fulfilled, and she has sometimes been amazed. Please give your very kindest and richest welcome to our poet, Rebecca Lee.
Thank you very much for that. It terrified me now. I'm going to read poems from this manuscript that he mentioned that I have been very afraid to send out anywhere. I haven't wanted to pull the staple out, so you have to forgive me for flipping around in here while I read that. Well, I'm going to start with April because, well, you may notice I don't write that many. I don't know if they're not upbeat, but they're not funny necessarily or happy poems. Although there's probably plenty of wonder and joy in them. But I'll start with some that are a little more upbeat. This is April. In spring, April seemed never to come to Illinois this year. So I think that's why I wrote this. I was trying to will it. April. Spring blurs the underbrush. An oak exhales, discards its bark. The woods are a mess. Still, there's bounty in it. This time of year, things move from sheer to tender. The river's syllabics and cuttings of light, a caress pressing forth. Surfaces still touched with chill, still cautious, but softening. I know this, the woods pulse, bracken and roots, the collapse of sparrows' nests, fallen limbs, evidence of how it is, and the earth smells lifting like subterfuge, like tactile steam from the loam and rot. I'm thankful now for the elms, for bristling water, how thaw throws off the ice and swallows it, how things lift toward flush and bulk, the wind brightening and loose. I remember everything suddenly, your wrists in sunshine, the leaves arriving like anthems. Old weather flickers, still raw some moments, still here, but easier. So wonder comes back with a grassy rush. A wren flirts in the new sprung and settled mesh. How intricate, how foolish and dear to believe each time that we've stumbled into something new. This poem, I'm living right now in Rock Island, Illinois, and when I first moved there to teach at Augustana, I was house-sitting for a colleague's cabin, which was out in the middle of nowhere. And I had as a companion a big Great Dane, and that was about it. And so I would take walks on this gravel road. It was beautiful out there. But there was a sense of something. I never saw anybody on this road, but I always saw evidence of, you know, tire tracks or a little pile of cigarette butts or, you know, a new gin bottle that hadn't been there the day before. So I always had this sort of tension between how beautiful this was and how lovely to be alone and the unnerving fact of being really alone out there. And the nearby town was called Preemption. That was the name of the town, which I love to drive through Preemption to go to this cabin. But, so this is called Beyond Preemption. It's possible there was no bridge painted a shocking teal, rust coming through like bruising. Or that when I dropped from the gravel road into the ditch of timothy and damp stones, there was no applause, no commentary from the cornfields, each stalk rustling, silk and husks. And that snake wrapped around the top strand of barbed wire. It's possible, I suppose, that it got there itself, that what appeared to be gray in cord, half stiffened, half paper, the proof of its finished life flaking off in the sun, had been a cadence, a taproot. Such things may not matter. It might be gone when I look for it next, brought down by rain, bird-pecked. I might begin to believe I imagined it. It's possible the world keeps its small horrors largely to itself, in spite of what we read, what we know. And the child's wagon down there in the creek bed, overturned, one side caved in beneath the pokeweed. I suppose it might not be anything after all. That poem is as much about mood, I think, as anything else. What it felt like to go for a walk in those woods. And this next one, too, when I did my graduate work, I was living in Washington, D.C. And I found those a rich couple of years, but I did not like living in Washington. And I was in I think most of the neighborhoods there are risky, and there was usually tear gas coming in through the screens and a lot of sirens and search helicopters and... So when I first wrote this poem, it's called Mount Pleasant Hydrangea. Mount Pleasant was my neighborhood. Hydrangea is a big blue flower that I had never seen before. And I wrote the poem one day after seeing a hydrangea in the front yard for the first time, just thinking of blue things. But after I left D.C. and came back to this poem, looked at it, I realized, I think as much as anything, it was about claustrophobia, maybe, or the place. The flower sort of turns into that. Mount Pleasant Hydrangea. Open the door to find no one who might have knocked, but instead, blue flowers hang heavy and obscene from stalks bent over the walk. Not aquamarine, not azure, not even sky blue, but blue like stained carnations, the sharp blue of plastic shovels and pails for the beach, like a notebook with the blue cover, the blue caps of pens. And these are the petals, and these the blue stems that grow in my rooms. At dinner, suddenly, they push up through the floor. Though the guests don't see how their legs are being wrapped in leaves, how the great blue blooms have reached their napkin laps, the cool bowls of soup. When we walk the streets, no one sees the flowers filling the children's mouths. The men lounging on storefront steps don't feel the blue anthers moving up through their pockets. There are stamens in the eaves, porches and bird baths overrun, pollen spilling from tailpipes everywhere. All right, this one is called Hoop Snake. Does anybody know what Hoop Snake is? This came out of a discussion with someone who told me there was a such creature as a hoop snake, and I didn't believe it. And so I looked it up, and the dictionary definition reads, any of several American snakes, such as the mud snake, that supposedly grasp the tail in the mouth and move with a rolling hoop-like motion. Well, I was being told that this existed, so we went to look it up, and supposedly it happened. Hoop snake. The second time we met, he told me about the hoop snake. Seductive, exquisite, a godless man. So I listened. While lightning took apart the sky, the fields leapt up, the stream's dark body slipped through the grass. The iris screamed, all tongue, sheen, and vanishing points. Lavender drenched the grass black. There are reasons to believe in God, and this seems a good one. Desire, suddenly, sadness, the unheard melodies sweet and the ones that catch. I don't remember what he said, his eyes flowering in the dark. After he left, I walked through the grass, the rain, asked, how do things work? We are after something miraculous. We open our mouths. We believe. We turn. At times, we gather speed. This one is a true story, I guess. My cousin and her husband years ago were working in a small village in Kenya. And they are both, he is a doctor, she was a student with me at St. Olaf College and a chemistry major. And we grew up together, very different personalities and temperaments. I never remembered details and specifics and those factoids that she always had right on hand. And so she and her husband went off and had this experience, which came back to our family through letters, and it fascinated me that this would have happened to them. So I wrote the poem. I'm going to read it and see if you can figure it out. It's called Ajabu Ajabu, which is a Swahili word for magical. Kenyan stamps on blue tissue, the usual pregnant arrival of words. Always a marvel with facts and specifics, she notices things no one else notices, then shares them with a practical generosity. You might as well know this. And after she says she's grown fat on chocolate, outlines a day of clinical work and tells of a hippo, the green mambas in the yard. There is something else, a woman in labor, undilated and staring into the eyes of something she arrived alone from the village. No supplies in the cabinets, no time, and 2 hours of one ruptured dirt road. They carried her to the jeep, knew they'd never make Migori before she collapsed. Then, how stunned we were to find the road repaired. The ruts filled in, tangled roots and rock removed, smoothed over. They made it in 45 minutes, delivered the woman and her child, and afterward asked when the road was restored, how, by whom. Why had they heard no shovels, no singing? The nurses shook their heads then, the hagglers in the market shrugged. At dusk, they turned the jeep for home, lurched back onto the road, and you must know this. She writes, of the endless ragged tracks, the old sprawling scar, and how for 2 hours, in silence, They labored their way back, each star beating down. I sent her a letter. They were there for 2 years, and I sent her a letter and asked, sent her the poem, actually, in the letter, and said, is this really what happened? You know, have I got it right, or did I get the wrong information? And I got a letter back from her saying, in her perfect style, no, that's pretty much what happened, only it was a Land Rover and not a Jeep. There you have it. Okay, I'm going to throw in, by request, a funny poem, a poem I've always found funny. It's very strange, so it's James Tate, who is a contemporary writer and writes surrealist poetry, and I'll just have to sort of flow with this one. I don't know that you can understand it, but it still makes me laugh every time I see it. It's called The List of Famous Hats. Napoleon's hat is an obvious choice, I guess, to list as a famous hat. But that's not the hat I have in mind. That was his hat for show. I'm thinking of his private bathing cap, which in all honesty wasn't much different than the one any jerk might buy at a corner drugstore now. Except for two minor eccentricities. The first one isn't even funny. Simply, it was a white rubber bathing cap, but too small. Napoleon led such a hectic life ever since his childhood, even farther back than that he never had a chance to buy a new bathing cap. And still as a grown-up, well, he didn't really grow that much, but his head did. He was a pinhead at birth, and he used, until his death, really, the same little tiny bathing cap that he was born in. And this meant that later it was very painful to him and gave him many headaches, as if he needed more. So he had to Vaseline his skull like crazy to even get the thing on. The second eccentricity was that it was a tricorn bathing. The scholars like to make a lot of this, and it would be easy to do. My theory is simple-minded, to be sure, that beneath his public head, there was another head, and it was a pyramid or something. James Tate, if you haven't read any James Tate, you should look for him. All right. This next poem is called Intarsia, which is the name of my manuscript. Intarsia was a kind of mosaic made out of wood, 15th century Italian, where designs and patterns were made by inlaying different colors and kinds of wood. Intarsia. Next door, a child shifts in sleep. Cats crouch in the roses. There's a man walking coatless through dark rain. And the days fill with such ordinary strangeness that taking the garbage out hurts. I have grown afraid of reflection, of both silence and squalls, of being alone in this. There's a boy in Rome whose eyes broke me, a Thai woman still bringing poppies in from the fields. In Jerusalem, a madman wears my watch. There are canaries hanging in doorways and cages, and from the Mount of Olives, such sweeps of cypress and white stone. Steam under surfaces, goats on roofs. Thin-legged boys hawk strands of shells. At Cape Comoran, the salt of three seas comes together. An old man wrapped in yellow waits on the rocks. The child next door is asleep in Cochin. The coatless man stands begging for coins in Bombay. His shirt of lace sparkles where it's held together with bits of wire, tiny pins. This next one is a little snapshot. I was in Paris last summer for the first time and saw this little scene, split second. Tunbridge, Pont des Arts. She's bent in a posture of anguish or prayer, in a spot of city filth, head down, a stained knit cap with its few coins on the ground beside her, and her pliant child, a shadow. Someone sweeps past with a friend in a clamor of rings and scarves. A pretty child skips after them, scattering pigeons. They miss how their daughter's eyes catch, the wary, open-mouthed stares, a terrible understanding passing between them, the bridge rippling under their feet. Before the polished child flashes past but looks back at the one on the bridge in the heat, the sun-blown, silent one, whose hand is pulled back and flown up to smooth, for a moment, her heavy hair. All right, this next poem is called Damage. I wrote it after watching a National Geographic special on tornadoes. I like storms, and I really like tornadoes, and I have not seen the tornado movie that came out this summer. And much to my despair, I've been told that some of the things that I have in this poem are in the movie, like a cow flying by, and so I don't know, I may have to wait a while before I send this out into public, but... called Damage. She decided those years had been water vapor, condensed, then ruptured into an updraft, the mad air ascending the vertical spin, flicking like a bullwhip over a field, the mouth of wind, an inkling. That's what it was like, she said, volatile conditions, the air rolling horizontally like a pencil, clouds the color of asphalt and moss, a disturbance first under the skin, then sibilance in the leaves, crescendo, ascent, a colossal vessel of air, assembling, lifting off like spun smoke, the invisible suddenly, utterly there, shapely, voracious, rising to wreckage, metal, shingles, his life, hers, glass and laceration. You do what it takes to keep yourself whole. In Andover, the sirens fail. Homes turn to shrapnel, roofs tear off like flimsy lids, rooms empty into the sky. The Golden Spur mobile home park flattened, gone. A sink in the street, a nightstand with its shot of vodka. She said she'd heard that coins fuse in pockets, that potatoes bake where they lay in the earth. Cows fly by screaming. In springtime, the warm, sweet hours between noon and the first star are most unstable. A car hovers 3 feet over the ground in Wichita, then it's gone. Garage doors sail the streets like sheets of paper. A woman sits in a ditch beside a tractor, gathers herself, her watch gone and her shoes, the tree at her feet blown to kindling. She swears, before it blew itself out, it turned scarlet, an elongated, seething heart, devouring a nursery of geraniums. They don't touch down, you know, she said. They take everything with them. The next one, some of you were in a workshop where we were talking about poems of longing and loss, poems that probe into the hardest parts of our lives. This one I wrote last fall because a cousin of mine, my age, with a 6-year-old son, was killed in a gun accident, shot by a friend who was showing him his gun. And it was is a difficult thing to come to terms with. So I wrote this poem called Accident. The yard vanishes, thickens with shadows and leaves that drift against the fence, rasping, fluid, a flurry of grass as the wind picks up and time pulls loose. Last week, a field of withering pumpkins and snow. Birds along the freeway, wrinkling miles of sky. Wind current of ash, the trip home. And the boy in his small dark suit brings a drawing of a bird, which he lays on his father's hands. More snow, a few flakes sparkling on his shoes. An accident that alters everything. Though time passes as before, the light falling, then lifted, audacious. People laugh in the streets, buy groceries and magazines. We go on, our pettiness and courage like wrong colors. I walk the next day over leaf stains through rain. I'm not ready for the umbrella that opens head on, as if it had been aimed point blank at close range, someone laughing behind its abrupt blooming. A sudden combustion of color, a shot. I'll put the sort of heavy ones in a little group. Next one is called Witness, and the poet that I did my graduate work with is Carolyn Porche. If you haven't read her work, she was in El Salvador doing human rights work with Oscar Romero before he was killed, and she has dedicated the writing in her life to speaking about those who disappear, about what happens. And this poem, actually, so I dedicated this to Carolyn, but I wrote it after reading an article in The New Yorker years ago called A Changed Vision of God, and it was about the blindness suffered by survivors of Cambodia's Holocaust under the Khmer Rouge. The person writing the article, Alec Wilkinson, had researched the phenomenon of Cambodian women, many of them out on the West Coast, who were experiencing blindness that there were no medical explanations for. And as they researched this, discovered that one thing that was in common was that they had lived through atrocities, and that this blindness was probably in reaction to that. So this is called Witness. And there's an epigram from the article. Mrs. Im Chian sometimes wonders if she is really alive or if she died in the rice fields. She feels that the beatings she received caused her soul to be driven from her body, and she sometimes believes that it is back in Cambodia. Witness. Years later, in another country, they wake to colored birds rising from their eyes, from eating leaves in the forest. Hunger that turned their mouths to air. Sometimes what they see breaks into prisms of light. Sometimes they remember. Fires stoked with photographs, visual evidence shedding the world. A child hurled by the ankles, his head collapsing against a tree. They can't see. They think maybe it was the dirt, the smoke emptying their eyes. Maybe the corpses, the mines along the path. Months without dreams, or the nightmares better than waking. Field work, abrasive sun, and the hunger. Everything changed into something else. Sometimes it lasts for months, a seeing through water. And again, the man who sold cloth, he said the statue of the Buddha wept in the temple. they remember also what they did not see. Fear brings it sometimes, the vanishing, the vacant marketplace, a tree, like the one where a cousin hung, a necklace of rope, a child broken in a field. Her mother watches her soul lift, sees an angel rising into the sun. Other times, shadows, a man's leg behind a shed, a face, the shape of a hand, passing before their eyes. Sometimes they wake to their lives in other places. Sometimes what they see is a flock of birds, a column of smoke, moments of light now and then, like a brief concentration of stars. I wrote this next poem after a dream. I'm not sure I've figured out what it means yet. It's called At the Gate, and the little epigram is, "Sentiment without action is the ruin of the soul." Edward Abbey. You're not there as you are each hour in life. On the pavement is rock, cress, and glass, manzanilla discarded. The blossoms collapsing and the cut stems, glittering trash. The mattress truck passes, thus exhaust. My eyes rebuild the groves of rubber, bamboo scaffolding. The beggar holding out his glass eye, asking me something. There are gates in this landscape. One is white stone with the names of the dead carved deep. It's all in Hebrew. The light here burns. There are bushes of blood in the sand. I am touching the fine groove of a name or a date, a reason for this lonely marker. I'm thinking of you, even then, wishing you would lay me down in the dust. No words, no relief. This gate is made of iron, black, and edging a smothered yard. I have wanted to show you there are angels and asps here. Wings and tongues. In the dream, I don't mind the sadness of this, that you stand in the yard behind it, and I in the street among overturned cars, fire billowing from windows. There's a gate that swings on a screaming hinge. The sound pains and arouses us, we who've been standing like this all night with the city watching. We need to touch. Knowing we're watched, though our fingers and tongues have been taken away. Some kind of exchange for the gift of our sight, or a price for our hesitation. Now I will read you a little found poem, a little collage, written by Kathleen Norris. If you haven't read her book Dakota, you should do that. She's also a poet, and this is a tiny little poem which she made by collaging words and phrases from Jesus' teachings. So she took the words, but she put them in particular order, and I think it's a beautiful prayer called Imperatives. Look at the birds. Consider the lilies. Drink ye all of it. Ask, seek, knock. Enter by the narrow gate. Do not be anxious. Judge not. Do not give dogs what is holy. Go. Be it done for you. Do not be afraid. Maiden, arise. Young man, I say, arise. Stretch out your hand. Stand up. Be still. Rise. Let us be going. Love. Forgive. Remember. Well, when G read last week, he said he doesn't write love poems, and I disagree with you, but I don't feel like I write them. I'll try. This is my attempt. It's called Heart's Itch. It has an epigram by a poet named Jane Miller, who's got a book called August Zero that you should read. The epigram is, a few blossoms, the lowly mountains, that pair in the tunnel of love. And it is a tunnel, and it is love. Heart's Itch. We walked undressed in a tawny field, and the heat on my legs where the sun hit. My God, your voice reeling into my ear. I believe in a source, I do, a soul, a reason, however unsound, even nostalgia and its distortions, in spite of the unmarked graves. Later, fire vines stitched over stucco, apples on a white plate, a freezer clacking with ice. There's something to it, something creaturely, raw in the stretch of your spine, your dear lips. Tonight, fog takes the ravine, an owl attends to the quiet. On a beach, a man pushes a cart with his life through the sand, a red glove, a shoe. The moon that scores his face perfects yours. Our collection of leaves crimps in the damp beneath the mirror. The sky is filling with black flowers. What are we to make of it? Love insists on the ludicrous, nicknames, kissing in the street. The heart itches to wed the astral and shabby, to resurrect ruins and remake them. But what is it, this mulish faith that wheels and gleams between us? A trace of headway? Recovery from loss? That pair of hawks overhead? And this one's called Prayer. This one, I read this to my students when it's finals time. It's a prayer about escaping the logic, memorizing all the things of the brain, and just being in your body. And this is called Prayer. It has a little epigram, just a run-on line from Tristan Zara, who's a Dada poet. I love you so I swear I do adore you, is the line. Prayer. From the wreck and tangle of the past moon, the past moment, every minute since this thirst began, I lean. I stumble toward you, hoping you've not turned away yet. Hoping there might be something here to hold your falling eyes, tack your feet to the floor. If I could escape my head for one day and come to you as tongue, as open mouth, proud hunger and thighs, as fingernail and footsole, lapis and emerald. If I could come to you without my voice pulling words around the sound, but just carry you with me to the water and walk our bodies in until our mouths are underneath us and making O's, marking us with sucking octopus and leech. If I could, I would leave the flimsy skin of my intellect on the sand, like a towel, a blouse, to change shape and texture with the wind. And then I think I'll just end with a couple short poems by poets whose work I love. Czeslaw Milosz, who teaches right now at Berkeley, but he's a Lithuanian poet. This one's called Encounter, and it strikes me that our experience at Holden is a little bit like this. For most of us, no matter how long you're here. So it's Encounter. We were riding through frozen fields in a wagon at dawn. A red wing rose in the darkness. And suddenly, a hare ran across the road. One of us pointed to it with his hand, That was long ago. Today, neither of them is alive, not the hare, nor the man who made the gesture. Oh, my love, where are they? Where are they going? The flash of a hand, streak of movement, rustle of pebbles. I ask not out of sorrow, but in wonder. And Lipo. You ask why I make my home in the mountain forest, and I smile, and I'm silent, and even my soul remains quiet. It lives in the other world, which no one owns. The peach trees blossom, the water flows.
Thank you very much. Invite them in. Well, it's over, so. Thank you all very, very much for coming. And we have a couple minutes if you want to ask questions about poetry in general, about any of these poems, about writing poems. The workshops the last 2 weeks have been a thrill for me because people have bravely come in and sort of on the spot tried writing about things that are not always easy to write about, and then even more bravely shared them with each other. And I find that thrilling. I mean, it's one of the reasons I love teaching creative writing. It's very risky and it's terrifying, but enormously rewarding, I think. And I'm hoping that people who are staying here longer, or those of you going back out into the world, will read and write poems. But do you have questions about, yeah?
Well, there were some of us that have been attending your workshops regularly, mm-hmm. that we thought we would start a writing group while we were continuing to stay here. So
yes.
Do you have any suggestions or input?
I'll give you a list of some texts. There's a book actually right now that was put together by a couple of poets who made a call to all their friends who are poets who also teach to get sort of exercises that, you know, in all those hours where you are not inspired from on high, you know, you sort of still have to put yourself through the work of it. So it's a book full of exercises.
Okay.
Good, yeah, I hope Holden strikes me that you could have readings weekly where people read their favorite poem by someone else or their own poems, or you could have workshops where you trigger each other. My mother is a poet, and she started writing poems when she was a frustrated young housewife, I think, with three little kids. And she and friends of hers got together and started doing this weekly, and been doing it for 35 years. I mean, the group's shifted a little bit, but it's quite amazing to me. Some of their books are down in the bookstore if you want. Her name is Karen Seth Wee. You can look for those in the poetry section. But she's convinced it's kept her alive, too. I believe it. Other questions? Yeah.
Have you ever written a letter to one of your favorite poets, like when you were young, and actually got a response?
Actually got a response. I did write, the earliest letter I remember writing to was, I loved Nancy Drew books, and I believed that there was an author writing all those books, which I, you know, learned way later that that was not the case. But I think her name was Carolyn Keene or something like that. And I wrote a letter, and I never heard back. But poets, if they're not horribly famous and really scattered, often will write back. Bravest thing I did was just quit a job that paid me very well to go to graduate school, to a school I knew nothing about, because Carolyn Forché, who's the poet whose work I had read as an undergraduate, she was teaching there, and I just thought, if it's a good enough school for her to teach, I'll go study there. And on a whim, you know, did this application and quit my job. And it's one of those moments where she has become a friend, but I look at that as a point where everything about my life changed. So I never believe anybody who says poetry doesn't matter or doesn't change lives. But,
Yeah, I encourage you. If you have a favorite poet, just give it a shot. They're often very clever. What? Someone has read my book?
What about your book now? Is it at a publisher now?
Well, G was making it sound... It is at a publisher who's considering it, and I don't know what they will finally do. It's a bad time for publishing poetry books. NDA grants and things have been, all the arts funds have been cut, and poetry, because it never really makes money, people do it out of love, and those people who have been publishing poetry out of love are having some trouble right now, so we'll see what happens. But I'll let you know. If someone takes it, I'll get the bookstore to have a copy. Put a couple down there in the
bookstore.
Anybody else?
It's a bit open-ended, but does a poem take shape in a particular way for you? I mean, is there a process? Are you musing over something for a long time? Are there images that stay with you? Do you just have to work at it and even... And no muses are around at all.
Yeah, yes, it's very different for me. When I'm being disciplined, I have to write every day, whether I'm in the mood or not, because it's like anything else. It's like exercising or playing your instrument, you have to do the drudgery of, I've got to sit down with my pen and write. I keep all sorts of notebooks. Ideas, when I get an idea, something I saw, I'll write it down in a notebook. I have a notebook of words, just words I like that sometimes trigger, just free associate. So I have all kinds of exercises I make up for myself. But that's different than when something actually happens, like the Ajabu poem or some of the accident poem, poems that are triggered by an incident. Those tend to come in a shape and a form, and I often don't work those much. And the shape of it on the page is a strange thing, too. I mean, they tend to come... The Ajabu poem is in two-line couplets. They don't rhyme or anything, but each little two-line stanzas. And I had a student ask me once why that poem was like that. And before I could say, I don't know, I have no idea, I just know it came like that, and I couldn't really change it. Another student piped in and said, well, it's obvious, it's like the tracks. It's in two lines like the tracks of the road. And I thought, yeah. That's what it is. That's why I did it. But I don't know. That might be. So there is something very mysterious about how the thing comes to the page. And I think the process is different for everybody. But I struggle... a long time over some of them and not very long over others, and I ruin them sometimes. I get a wonderful idea and I work it too hard and finally the initial energy is gone. I've also, made the mistake of getting a poem and being so excited that I got something that I refused to touch it and realized later it really wasn't that good, but I had loved it so much for being born that I had just left it there. So. Anybody else?
There's a poetry competition, if anybody's interested. Point No Point in Seattle is a publication. There's a prize for $1,000, which is rare.
Is it for a poem?
For poetry, yeah.
Not for a manuscript. That's...
Yeah.
Yeah, that's nice.
So Point No Point.
Send stuff in. There are quite a few. If you're interested in publishing poetry, there are quite a few competitions. It's just that there are also a lot of people writing, thank goodness, but it means it's hard for something to surface.
How does environment affect your poetry? I grew up in Reynolds, Illinois, and went to Oxford.
Oh, yeah. I think, I grew up in the Midwest in Minnesota, and when I moved out east, I was very agitated in my skin, and I think there were a lot of reasons for that, but I think I discovered that one of it was sort of landscape, and I write a lot about trees. And I discovered my grandmother gave me a poem that she had in a drawer that I had written when I was 6. I have no recollection of it, but it's all about trees. And I thought, I've always been doing this. I don't know why. But landscape is pretty big for me. Where I am when something happens, often what I remember more than even my own reaction is what room I was in or what the light was like or what the air was like. Anyone else? Well, thank you again very, very much for coming and listening.